The sheriff was on the street, backed up by his posse. The outlaws were holed up in the hotel, and then...
The gun went off. Bullet went through Colonel Cox's lapel, and everything broke loose.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the surprising story of the Bellevue-Iowa War of 1840, back when Iowa was the Wild West. Then later in the hour, all six Littleton brothers from Toolsboro, Iowa in Lawiza County went off to serve in the Civil War. None of them came home. It's the largest loss of life in one immediate family in any U.S. war. We'll hear the story. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we revisit two unique events in Iowa history. Later in the hour, the six Littleton brothers of Toolsboro, Iowa, who all gave their lives fighting for the North during the Civil War. But first, there was a time when what is now the mild Midwest was the Wild West, and Belleville, Iowa, on the Mississippi River, is planning a celebration to commemorate that time. Susan Lukey is a member of the Bellevue Arts Council, and she is leading a quest to find the descendants of the men involved in what is known as the Bellevue War of 1840. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, you're most welcome. We're delighted to do this.
And you are preparing to celebrate the 175th anniversary of the Bellevue War next year. And you're starting now because you're hoping to find the descendants of the people who were involved?
We are. We're actually planning. There is a celebration. It's an art fair. That's an annual event. But in conjunction with that, we're going to do the 180th of the town and an observance of the 175th. We'd like to do it as a historical cultural event. And we are. We think we're the first place in maybe America, we don't know, that ever tried to find vigilantes and outlaws, to descendants, to come back to the scene of the event. The Bellevue War is very complicated. It's complex, rather. It's a history, really unique part of American history, and it's been kind of a sleeper for a long time.
Yeah.
So we're hoping the story gets out and that we get real people to come back.
So you're not just looking for the good guys. You're looking for the bad guys, too.
We're looking for anybody that was either boots on the ground or a bystander. So far, I've had responses and three commitments of one of the original pioneer families of Bellevue, also Wisconsin, and I'm talking with California right now. We have an excited person out there, and also from Bettendorf, Iowa.
Wow. All right. Well, let's dig into this story.
Okay.
And it goes way back in time. The story kind of starts in 1837 when some shady folks started coming to town. Tell me what happened.
Well, the first person it rather pivots on is William W. Brown. He was a young man. He was probably in his late 20s, early 30s, came with his wife and small child, and came out of Coldwater, Michigan area, Elkhart, Indiana, County, Indiana area, and came here. And according to the stories I found, he was engaged in a land deal with a man who was quite shady. But Brown looked like an upstanding entrepreneur, and he settled in town. And it was in about the fall of 37, when he first started to open his hotel, that some shady characters that worked for him showed up as woodcutters. And then things started to happen, and Bellevue endured it for about 3 years.
All right, and tell me what kind of things started to happen.
Oh, there was rustling, there was robbery, there was assault, there was counterfeiting, horse thieving. A lot of it pivoted around Brown's hotel, and in those days you didn't have to have a law degree, so Brown himself acted as what was then called a pettifogger. He was very intelligent, quite charming and creative. There was a young sheriff who was also in his early 30s and not married at the time, and he and Brown had a really interesting relationship, because in those days you couldn't just run down to the 7-Eleven. You had to depend on people in the community. So there was a lot of interaction between Brown and the townspeople, and all this started to go on, but it kind of always led back to the hotel.
Okay, and at that time, I mean, you mentioned the sheriff in town. William Warren is his name, right?
Yes.
All right. What kind of law and order was there in Bellevue in 1837, 1838?
It was a little thin. Bellevue was actually in Iowa territory at the time. We didn't become a state until 1846. And we were kind of bandied around after the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. We were part of the Louisiana Territory, which was huge. Then it's just like my real estate now, it gets pared down. Then we were part of the big Michigan Territory. Then we were part of the Wisconsin Territory. And then we were Iowa Territory. And we were just barely Iowa Territory. And so the law was spread very thin. And the history of vigilantism in America is that it ran parallel to law. It wasn't always in opposition to formal law. And they needed the help of the people to help with law enforcement. So Sheriff Warren had one or two deputies, and he was pretty much trying to cover three counties at first and then finally just Jackson. But he was based in Bellevue.
Well, and I think about those towns along the Mississippi River at that time. It was during this time when Davenport had the reputation of being the wickedest town in the West, right?
Well, it was probably running a close second to what was then called Cutnose. It's now Montrose down in southeastern Iowa. And then, Bellevue was seen as an enterprising spot, and so it attracted these people because there had been very, very early vigilantism movements in the very South, because the Deep South was getting along the river. Rivers were the interstate systems of those days, and so they attracted criminal traffic. And then they started to move north and, of course, came down from the northeast. And so Bellevue was really a plum spot for some type of an operation to be set up.
All right. So when did things come to a head? Was there an event that made Sheriff Warren think, we cannot let this continue?
There was. In January of 1840, that was a bad winter. And basically, this outlaw group were bullies. Brown would mitigate things at the hotel. He never cheated people at the hotel. He was always scrupulously honest. He had a grocery store, and these men cut wood. He had a wooding business. He also had a butcher shop in conjunction with one of the Bellevue people, and there was allegedly some rustled stock that showed up there, so that got closed. And he would be scrupulous in his local dealings. It was what his men were doing. So that whole town, that whole winter, Bellevue was rather terrorized. And there was an outspoken few people, Henderson Palmer, a blacksmith, and James Mitchell, a merchant, who were also on the front lines verbally against this group. And they weren't an isolated gang. These gangs were confederated up and down the river, so people moved among the gangs. There was rarely an isolated gang, and it wasn't unusual for a leading citizen of the town to be upstanding in the day and an outlaw leader at night. With Brown, there were people on both sides who said he was totally upstanding, and there were people who said he was one of these duplicitous people.
Well, so, given the power of his group and all of his connections, this sounds really dangerous to try to crack down on anything that was going on.
People were afraid of him. In that winter, they decided they couldn't celebrate Christmas, so they had a ball. They were going to celebrate the New Orleans victory of Andrew Jackson. That was a popular holiday at the time. While that was going on in the new hotel down on Front Street, Brown's right-hand man, who was also kind of charming but had turned into an alcoholic, he took some of the boys up and they robbed Mitchell's house, put his stuff on a wagon, sent it across the river. And then, according to legend, the girl who was in the house, I think she was probably a servant, ran into the hotel in her nightgown and reported it. But according to the court testimony I found, she actually was attacked by him. And so Mitchell went gunning for him, and they had a confrontation on Front Street. The outlaw James Thompson's gun misfired. James Mitchell, he managed to hit Mitchell across the face with a knife, and Mitchell shot him and then went back into the hotel. The gang showed up, started shooting through the ceiling to try to get Mitchell to come down, and the sheriff showed up, and then Brown showed up, made a big display of getting the men out of there and telling them, you know, they better take care of this or they're going to lynch Mitchell. And so they went away, and a few minutes later, Brown came around the back door and advised the sheriff on how to deal with it.
Oh, my goodness. So,
yeah, he actually saved, in the course of the following 3 months, he saved the sheriff's life at least three times.
This sounds like not just something out of an old Western movie, but it sounds like it's out of Maverick or something, a comedy even.
There is a deputy who's an absolute hoot, who is a side story of humor. It does. It sounds just like a TV script. The story, the core story itself, is so worthy of one of the best TV shows or movie series you could have, TV series. But around that, it's as if he dropped a pebble into the pond, and around that is regional history, American history, and also the evolution of America law and the frontier. This is a unique window. There isn't much from this period of time that's eyewitness, and the sheriff wrote his memoirs in the 1870s. He was in the Civil War as an officer. He came back, and his young son had died, who lied about his age and got into the military. So the sheriff was friends with the newspaper editor, and he wrote his memoirs, and I actually was privileged to be into the archives deep, deep down, and I actually saw these memoirs, and I thought, this is too good. There's been so much false legend, and this is the true. And then around it, there have been controversies in 1879, and in 1910, there were huge controversies when county histories were published of people who had allegiance to Brown and still stood by him.
Wow. Okay, well, let's get back to this episode.
Sure.
Bellevue history. Sounds like we could talk all day. All right, so things had kind of come to a head. And Sheriff Warren realized he had to do something. So what did he do? How did he try to take action?
He, from all of the writings, even the controversial ones, he did try, and it wasn't him alone. It were these leading citizens, James Mitchell, Henderson Palmer, and some others, who tried to act as a group and actually went to Dubuque. There was a judge up there named Thomas Wilson, who later went on to Great Iowa Political Things, and as did some of the people in the Bellevue War. And they went and they tried to get warrants, and Brown would always find out about it. And finally they did get a warrant. The sheriff brought it back to town, and Brown met him at the edge of town, and he said, you don't want to read this warrant. And then Mrs. Brown came and said, run for your life. The guys are coming. They heard about this. Anson Harrington, who had signed the warrant, it was across the river already in hiding. They had warned him. So then it went on until a few days later, and it was April 1st, and there was a politician named Thomas Cox who sort of was a driving force into, let's deal with this. We dealt with it in Illinois when I was over there, and, you know, deal with it now. And he went on to survey Iowa City and do a lot of things for Iowa. So he had clout. And he wanted the sheriff to move, so the sheriff rode out to find a posse, and he didn't find a lot of people that were either not too scared or allied with Brown and thought he was okay. There were no banks, so Brown was making loans. Turned out later he himself was borrowing. But he was acting like a bank for a lot of people, giving credit at his store. It was
so
hard economic
time. A lot of people were depending on him. We're going to take a short break, and then we will get back to the Bellevue War of 1840 in just a moment. With me is Susan Lukey. She is a member of the Bellevue Arts Council, and she's leading a quest to find the descendants of the men involved in the Bellevue War of 1840. We will continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're taking a look at two unique events in Iowa history. Coming up in a little while, we'll talk about the six Littleton brothers who all died in the Civil War fighting for the Union Army. But right now, we are talking about an unusual event. It's called the Bellevue War of 1840, and it took place in Bellevue, Iowa, right along the Mississippi River. And with me is Susan Lukey. She's a member of the Bellevue Arts Council. And Susan, we were right up to the beginning of this actual conflict. So we've got Sheriff Warren on one side. He has his arrest warrants drawn up. And then we have the charming entrepreneur criminal William Brown on the other side. And you, there's this wonderful little piece of dialogue that was in the newspaper. And so I don't know how accurate it was, but Brown says, "You propose to arrest us?" "Yes," replied Warren. "That is my idea." "That is, if you can," replied Brown. "There's no if about it," said Warren. "I have a posse of 40 armed men at my back, and I'm going to make the arrest." So it sounds just like dialogue out of an old Western. So what happened?
I think that's from a novel that was written early in the 1900s.
Okay.
I'm not sure where that came from, but I'm not sure it ran quite that black and white, but it did. Brown, the sheriff rode, and Thomas Cox, he asked him to find some posse members from another direction. So the sheriff came back into town the morning of April 1st. He had been out on the road for about a day. And he came back, and he brought a few men with him, and he started to ride up Front Street, and he went past the hotel, and there were about 23 affiliates of Brown plus Brown in the hotel, and one of them was an Irishman named Conley, and he had a banner. Either it was out the window, or he was walking around on the street with it that said victory or death, and they started to throw things at the sheriff on his horse as he passed by. And there was a lot of rowdyism going on, and Brown stepped out and stopped it. And then the sheriff went down the street, and he caucused, and they left 40 men up the street that were unarmed because guns weren't that common in those days. Horses weren't. That's all post-Civil War, war between the states. And here these were farmers. I mean, 90% of the population were farmers at that time, and a lot of them walked where they were going. So the other men who were armed, and those were single-shot cap-and-ball guns, they came down the street with the sheriff. And at first the sheriff tried to negotiate, and Brown came out and told him to bring four principal Bellevue citizens with him, not Palmer and Mitchell, because they had some heated conversations, and some other older gentlemen. And he came down, and right when they got to the hotel, Brown said he just wanted the sheriff. So the sheriff went inside, and they held him hostage, and Brown took him to a separate room, and the sheriff asked if he could talk to Brown, and he showed him written forms of people who asked him to surrender. They wouldn't be hurt. They would abide by the court process, such as the court where it was at that point. It was a circuit court that came around. Bellevue had no jail. And Brown said, well, you know, he gave one of his, what the sheriff later called, Iago-like answers. He said he wished he could, but he was in too deep. He was going to stand with his men. And then he said to the sheriff, you go out and tell them to stop because Colonel Cox is coming down the street with the armed 40 men.
No, wait a minute. Wasn't he holding the sheriff hostage?
He was. He said, you go out there and you tell them to stop and you come back here. The men were drinking in the saloon next to the store, and he knew it was getting out of control. So he knew the sheriff wouldn't come back.
Right.
But that was what he said, and the sheriff left. Sheriff went back down and he told
him
what was going
on. So it sounds like he really didn't want the sheriff.
Walking toward the hotel.
It sounds like he didn't want the sheriff to get hurt.
They had a mutual respect in the sheriff's writings. He talks of him at first as if he was evil, and then as it goes along, you can tell there was a mutual respect there. And he did save the sheriff's life three times. They walked up the street together across. The sheriff was in the front row with Colonel Cox and Henderson Palmer, and they walked up to the porch, and they stopped outside of the porch. And you have to realize these weren't big buildings. This was a frame building, and it was down on the corner on Front Street. And they walked up to the porch, and Brown stepped out on the porch. By some accounts, he opened the door. By other accounts, he walked out on the porch. But I think he was inside the building. And the sheriff said he went to lower his gun, assuming that he was going to surrender, but other reports said that he fired, but the gun went off. Bullet went through Colonel Cox's lapel, and everything broke loose. So it was a gunfight. Two men went around the north window and shot at Brown, and it went right, severed his jugular vein, and he dropped. And the men were fighting, and the sheriff ordered them to light the hotel on fire.
So they got inside, and
then the men started to go out the back windows over the back porch of the hotel.
So they're burning the hotel around there,
and they went hand to hand combat.
Okay,
there was so much smoke from these single shot rifles.
They put out the fire to save the hotel. Somebody had the time to do that in the midst of trying to chase down the outlaws.
They were efficient. It wasn't a real big building. Well, the reason they did it was because there was an outbuilding on the side, and there were men shooting at him from there, too. And so he just sort of went into full force assault. And anyway, they got 13 of them. Some of them got away. Some were wounded that got away. And they put the fire out and rounded them up, what they caught, and then they had to decide what to do with them.
Okay, so and that was quite the issue because, you know, here we are on the frontier justice, we think about hanging, and the sheriff didn't want to hang him.
Everybody was so frustrated with these bullies that there was a huge hue and cry. They were like, go get ropes, let's just do it. And the sheriff prevailed on them not to do anything they were going to regret, and he got Colonel Cox to talk to him, and Colonel Cox was all for hanging him, but he you know, calmed him down. They made food because they had been at this all day, and it was now 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They cooked for the food for them.
Lunch break.
And everything. And they put them under house arrest overnight. And then the next day they held a people's court. And then they were confronted with the decision of hanging or whipping, because the original definition of lynching from the Scotch-Irish on the East Coast was you whipped them and exiled them, and that was kind of a death sentence if you didn't have a horse and a gun. Not so much in 1840. It started to mean hanging, so they had to decide what to do.
Okay, so they took a vote
they
on,
had
on whether they would hang them or whip them.
And they had impassioned arguments, and finally they agreed to go with the vote. So they voted in the traditional way that goes back to the Greeks and probably further, because paper was in short supply and so was literacy in some cases. They voted by red, by colored and white beans, and by three colored beans they voted to whip them rather than hang them.
All right. So they whipped them, and then they sent them off down the river.
They did, and William Fox, who was the ringleader after the death of James Thompson, he sort of was the self-appointed ringleader and not at all the polish of Thompson. He actually came back on an island, sent word to the sheriff a couple weeks later, and he had left his billfold with Mrs. Brown, and she sent his billfold, supplies, and clothes, and the sheriff took him down on the island.
Now, why would the sheriff do that?
Well, people realized, well, I think he had a good heart. I really did look in the book, I looked closely at his character, and I think he really did not want to, even though later he hanged a person under his duties as a sheriff, he didn't want people to suffer if he thought they learned their lesson. And Fox was really humble, but then in 1845, he was one of the ringleaders that killed Colonel Davenport when his family was gone to the 4th of July celebration. They went into his house to rob him as an elderly man, and he died from his wounds. So Fox was never, ever reformed. And right as I was finishing the manuscript to go to press, I had a call from a woman who said that she was his many times great-granddaughter and that he had escaped, which we know he did, in Indiana and had settled somewhere and lived to 103.
Wow.
But I didn't get any identification from her because it was one of those days when I just thought she'd call back. I said, please call me back. And she didn't do that, or if she tried, I didn't get the call. So I'm hoping she comes out when she sees this.
So in planning this celebration, the 175th anniversary of the Bellevue War, you want to get as many descendants as you can of the outlaws and of the posse and of the sheriff as possible to come back to the celebration. What gave you that idea?
Well, again, we're kind of doing it as an observance. We want Iowa to understand that this is a rich, rich story on many levels of its history. And last year, the Arts Council painted a mural on a building downtown and asked me to be the keynote speaker. I actually don't live in Bellevue anymore. I live in Ames. I work for Iowa State University for many years. But I'm back here. I have family back here, and my mom's still back here. So I'm back here for a while, and I am helping them with this. And I also am a member of the Arts Council, and I was the keynote speaker. And it just kind of popped into my head as an afterthought while I was up on the podium, and I said, next year's 175th, and there have to be descendants. So we just decided to go with it and see what would happen. And I put the first news releases out about 2 weeks ago, and it's been very interesting since. So I'm really, really, really after the sheriff's family who moved west. The last survivor's descendants I can find are, I believe, in California. But I have some leads in Iowa I'm going to pursue of people who know people, just in case. So I'd love to have the sheriff back. And we do have a critic of the Bellevue Art coming and a supporters. So it's going to be interesting when we see those people like four generations down.
Are you going to have
excited?
Are you going to
have guilt anymore? It's just history.
Are you going to have a reenactment?
We are. We have local reenactors who are actually very good. They did it last year. It's very popular, and they've taken great pains to try to be as much as you can in a short little dramatic presentation accurate. And it was very well done last year, so we're hoping and planning to have that again this year. It takes a lot of people to pull that off, but it's on the agenda. And right now until December, when we have the first planning meeting, we are in the search mode. So, you know, I call it the fishing phase.
Oh, well, Susan, so anybody who thinks they had ancestors in Bellevue in 1840, you pretty much want them to get in touch with you.
It would be excellent.
All right.
And there's a web address, info@bellevuearts.org, and it's in the press releases that went out. If they could just email us, we will get back in touch with them.
All right. Susan, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
Susan Lukey of the Bellevue Arts Council. She's looking for the descendants of people who were involved in the Bellevue War of 1840. She is also the author of The Bellevue War, Mandate of Justice or Murder by Mob. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and now we're going to talk about another unique event in Iowa history. At the beginning of the Civil War, there were 10 members of the Littleton family of Toolsboro, Iowa, in Louisa County. Six brothers left behind four sisters and went off to fight for the Union Army. None of the men survived the war. It is, to the best of our knowledge, the largest loss of life in any one family in any U.S. war. And it's a story that was very nearly lost to history. Tom Woodruff is a member of the Louisa County Historical Society. He's brought this story to light and is doing his best to honor the memories of the six Littleton brothers. Hello, Tom.
Well, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And how did this story come to light? Because it was nearly lost.
We describe it as almost providential that the story was contained in a group of old Louisa clippings put together by a very old lady whose family moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. They were cleaning out the estate there. Their relative called me. An old high school friend said, I want to get rid of all this junk. Would you like to see clippings from Louisa County? I said, yes. We were in the process of publishing many stories for the Louisa County Historical Magazine, and it looked like a great source of stories. This one turned out to be really great.
Wow. And what was the clipping that was in this old scrapbook that so easily could have wound up at a landfill somewhere? What was the clipping that tipped you off, that made you want to look deeper?
I thumbed through 57 pages of a huge scrapbook. And on page 27 was a reference to six brothers named Littleton, spelled with a Y, who had died in the Civil War. And they were from our home county near where I grew up. I thought I was sort of imagining things, contacted the Historical Society. A few months later, we verified the name was spelled wrong and the story was actually true.
Wow. And this was a story that no one at the Historical Society knew anything about?
It's just amazing, isn't it? It's almost like it should have been lost. For 150 years,
wow,
to really add importance to the story. That's right. Our best historians lived on farms near this site where these boys grew up. They did not know it.
Wow. Well, let's start talking about some of the things that you uncovered, because
sure,
you went back into the history and you found out some amazing things about this family. They have a remarkable story that predates the Civil War. They came to Iowa in 1840, I think, right? And on the census reports, on one of the census reports, the family's race is designated as mulatto. What does that mean?
We talked to Professor Leslie Schwamm here at length about that meaning. It could have meant many things at the time. If we go strictly by the definition, accepted at that time, and we can accept those who did the census correctly, it would have been part African-American and part other white mixtures. We didn't make that the emphasis of the story. It was the fact that six brothers came with their parents, some of them born on the way in Ohio, arrived here, were able to buy 200 acres of land, farm it, and then pass away before their boys volunteered for service, in itself is a remarkable story. What happened to the girls is quite a story.
Well, I can't wait to get into more of that, but I do think it's very interesting because this family was brought to Iowa with the help of abolitionists, right?
We believe that to be true because of the neighborhood they settled in. There were some very strong abolitionists there, as well as Mormon families who were right across the river at Nauvoo. So there are a number of ties we have not yet established.
And there were 10 children in the family, at least 10 surviving children in the family. And you mentioned, were many of them already born when they moved to Iowa?
There were two or three that were born when they moved to Ohio.
Okay.
There was another child or two born there. The other four or five were born in Iowa.
Wow.
We think they had to stop in Ohio to have children.
Yeah, sounds like it. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll get back to this story in a moment. I'm talking with Tom Woodruff. He's a member of the Loayza County Historical Society. And we are talking about six brothers from Loayza County, the six Littleton brothers. They all went off to serve in the Civil War to fight for the Union Army, and none of them survived. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about unique events in Iowa history, and right now we're focusing on the story of six brothers who fought in the Civil War and all lost their lives. It is, to the best of our knowledge, the largest loss of life in any one family in any U.S. war in history. And all six of these brothers were from Loayza County, Iowa. Tom Woodruff is here. He's a member of the Loayza County Historical Society. He has worked very hard to bring this story to light and is working very hard to memorialize the lives of these brothers. We'll talk more about some of the projects in the works in a little while. But, all right, the family came to Iowa in 1840. 10 children were eventually born into this family, 6 boys, 4 girls. Martha was the mother, James was the father, and they both pass away before the Civil War.
And tragically, one of the brothers married and lost a wife and an 18-month-old girl prior to joining the service. The story is full of tragedy.
Wow. So when the Civil War comes around, these six brothers all sign up for service. And, of course, we know that Iowa was a place where a lot of men signed up for service in the Civil War, more volunteers per capita than any other state in the North. As they signed up, did they all go to the same unit or at the same time? What happened?
Of the six brothers, 3 joined the 19th Iowa. The other 3 were in different infantry regiments, 1 out of Illinois. But they all volunteered, importantly. And only one, really, of the 6 was killed directly in battle. The other 5 either died of disease or from wounds as a result of that war. Only one came home.
And he came home very sick.
Yes. He was in the Battle of Harper's Ferry, captured, released, came home ill, and died soon after.
The 6 brothers were George, John, Kendall, Noah, Thomas, and William. In your research, have you been able to track the trajectory of each one of these brothers?
Yes, with a lot of help, including Ed Bain, my co-worker from Wapello, and Jan Haley there at the Wapello Library, and many other people have been involved. My wife and I, have visited every battle site and every place of burial that we know about, and it's been a great experience.
So which one of the brothers died in battle?
I'm drawing a blank at the moment.
That's okay. That's okay. But I didn't mean to put you on the spot
okay.
there. There are a lot of them. So sure. I know one of them died. Actually, he drowned in a ferry crossing.
That was Noah on the White River near Forsyth. And we visited that site in with historians there, and probably one of the most memorable sites as part of the story that I visited.
Why? What made it so memorable?
I was able to climb down the bank, see the pin driven into the bank that supported the broken cable of the ferry that they were ferrying these boys and their mules across the river. The rope broke. Down the river they went, and five boys drowned. Standing there just looking at that pin that held that rope, and having been raised in Loiza County on the Mississippi and the Iowa rivers, I associated the tragedy of water, what it could do.
Right. That was a moment that brought you very close to this
yes.
history. So you traced the paths of all of the brothers through the war and all of their deaths. What do you know about the sisters they left behind?
We have found descendants of three sisters. And by the way, none of these descendants knew anything about their history. So you can imagine the interesting phone calls
right.
that were made. The fourth girl, we're not totally sure about her descendants or where she went. But we have personally talked. And by the way, that family, since the discovery, have held a family reunion, and almost 50 of them showed up to celebrate their heritage.
Wow. So you've really given them a tremendous gift.
Yes.
Now, in doing this research and sharing the story in Loiza County, you have also been working to raise enough funds to create a memorial for the brothers. And I want to bring Will Thompson into the conversation. He's the creative director and proprietor of Armadillo Arts, and he's designed this memorial that will be in Loiza County. Hello, Will.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And how did the two of you connect? How did you wind up working on this project?
Well, Tom and I had collaborated during the development of the Devonian Fossil Gorge project up at the Coralville Reservoir. And I was one of the designers who created the exhibit area out there. And so Tom called me up one day and told me the story and asked me if I'd be interested in participating and maybe developing a memorial.
And what was it about the project that appealed to you?
Oh, I think that the most important thing for me is that it's all about completing circles in life when you have an opportunity like this to take the heritage of a story and connect it to the present time. That's always a big effect. But I'm a museum person. I've built exhibits for museums for 42 years, and it's what I do. So telling stories, expanding on the meaning of things, that's what it was about for me.
Tell me about the memorial you've designed.
Well, it's an asymmetrical black granite stele, 9 feet tall on top of a 2 foot berry gray granite base. And on one side, there will be etched a drawing that shows six soldiers disappearing into the fog of war. And underneath, there's the legend that from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the last full measure of devotion. And on the base, there's the name of the family, Littleton. And on the other side, there's a paragraph of text that tells their story. This total height of this monument will be 11 feet. It's broken off at the top. And that's from an old Victorian convention. If you go to a cemetery in Iowa today, you'll find old stones that are often columns or tree trunks, and the top is broken off or sawed off. And it is sort of a Victorian motif for a life cut short. And so the top of this monument is broken off diagonally. And to me, that represents these six lives that were cut short by war.
And you're hoping, Tom, to dedicate this memorial in 2016? Is that the timeline?
Hopefully 2015.
2015, okay.
We've had such support from many people that in the next week we will be talking to engineering firms to do construction plans. We're starting a major fundraising kickoff in just a few days. So a lot of people will be hearing from us.
And have you already secured land?
Yes, and fortunately, the Loisa County Board of Supervisors, when Ed Bain and I went to them about a site, we were thinking of the courthouse lawn. Randy Griffith of the Board of Supervisors said, we've got this great spot down near Toolsboro, a mile or two from the Boys Home Farm. It was a site that we had liked but never imagined that they would let us use it. They have, and it's a site that perhaps Will can tell you the significance of this location.
So, Will?
Well, the site is immediately adjacent to a state historic site called Toolsboro Mounds, which is a Hopewell complex of Native American burial mounds that flanks the top of a bluff there. There are large village sites that once occupied that space of land that date back into prehistory. The Oneota and the Iaway had traditional villages there. They were fairly continuously occupied in that region up until the end of the Black Hawk War. So it is historically significant. The spot is adjacent to the County Highway 99, so there's good visibility there. We plan to do some native Iowa landscaping of the site when we put up the monument and add six trees, one dedicated to each of the brothers.
Six oak trees is your plan, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that's on hopefully on target for 2015. You are in the midst of a tremendous fundraising effort, not just for the memorial, but for other projects involving this history and making sure that people know about it. What are your plans?
We've been encouraged by many people to do everything possible and do it now. We do plan after the memorial signage on interstates, the counties, to direct tourists and people there. We have a documentary planned. Our plans are underway for a book or novel. And a kind of a nice little thing, we are working with a high school there to develop some kind of a play. So perhaps locally it'll be reminded on a regular basis the story of the boys that came out of Loisa County.
And you're working on a book yourself?
Or we put together a small book. Okay. But no, this will be by people who are a little more skilled at this than we are.
So as you're working to get people excited about this, what kind of a response are you getting? What do people say?
There are so many positive responses. I just had a phone call this morning from an older lady in Rock Island who had a tremendous historic background and wanted to write a check. The ironworkers out of Burlington called me and wanted to aid in any way they could. Having the First Lady of Iowa at our fundraising kickoff last week added a great deal to this. The governor himself has been involved, as well as several state senators. Representative Tom Sands from our area has a house file passed to be given to the Historical Society and members of the Littleton family. There are many blog sites now with stories, so a lot going on.
Well, I think about the story of the five Sullivan brothers from Waterloo, Iowa, who, of course, all tragically died in war. And that is a story that has really captured a lot of people's imagination and inspired a great deal of change in the way the U.S. military operates. This is six brothers. Do you find that the people are responding to that just because of the tremendous amount of loss in this one family?
It's hard for me to be so involved to properly gauge people's feelings. But I know a number of them are written checks. And that is an indication to me that it's important.
Right. Well, Will, as you've been working on this monument, I'm sure you've also been telling people about this story. What do you think really captures people's imagination?
I think it's the dedication that these boys showed in getting involved in the Civil War on the basis of their beliefs and their courage. And I think that that's the timeless element of the story, and that's what reaches out to people, is that these young men felt that fighting for union and freedom was something that they needed to put their lives on the line for.
What do you think, Tom, what do you think it says about the state of Iowa that these six men came from Iowa?
People in Iowa still stop their car and take off their hat when a funeral procession goes by. It tells a lot about Iowa. It tells me that there was a time in the history of Iowa when you were looked at not based on your appearance, but on what you contributed in the community. I think that still exists. We just have to find it, and perhaps this is a way we will do it. County of Loayza has a hometown pride effort going. We know it's going to add to that. The theme of Loayza County is Naturally Loayza. We want to do this as Will has designed the area around this monument in a natural way, and it fits directly with the hometown pride effort that they're making in that county.
There were so many lives lost during the Civil War, and I think it's quite telling that one of these brothers died during battle and all the others died of other causes during the Civil War. What do you want people to know about the Civil War from that piece of information?
I think in some of the material Will has prepared for us, he's very good at sharing our feelings. And as one of the Littleton family members said, it's ordinary people who give so much. They come from anywhere. We were so fortunate in Iowa, Loayza County, to have these young men, simple men from simple families who gave so much. That tells a good story.
It's so heartbreaking to think that this family came to Iowa, and it was a time when, for a mixed-race family, it was a very difficult time in the United States. They came to Iowa for opportunities, and there were so many opportunities, but then six men lost their lives.
Quite a story.
Yeah.
And it happened in Iowa.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, thank you so much for bringing this story to light.
Thank you.
And if people are interested in finding out more about your fundraising efforts or getting involved, how can they do that?
I'll take any kind of a phone call.
Okay.
You want my phone number?
No, I think if people go to the Loayza County Historical Society website, they can find more information and get in touch with Tom. Tom Woodruff is a member of the Loayza County Historical Society. And Will Thompson, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Will Thompson is creative director and proprietor of Armadillo Arts. He designed this memorial that hopefully, if things continue as planned, will be dedicated in the year 2015 in the memory of the six Littleton brothers from Loayza County who lost their lives in the Civil War. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, a conversation with Céline Cousteau. She's a French explorer, oceanaut, and granddaughter of Jacques Cousteau. This is Talk of Iowa.
Fresh air coming up next at 11. Iowa sky mostly clear.